Right, where should we start again from there? Well, I think we were talking about the unofficial movement. So how did it start up in the 50s, the original Merseyside Port Workers Committee?
There were two Port Workers Committees on Merseyside. There was the Birkenhead Port Workers Committee, which had always been separate, and the Liverpool Port Workers Committee. The Birkenhead Port Workers Committee had actually supported and come out in solidarity with the London Port Workers Committee on the Canadian Seamen's Strike.
That was the 49 strike.
I can never remember whether it's 48 or 49. There was the...
It's 49.
The red oxide strike in the Canadian Seamen's.
The zinc oxide.
Zinc oxide strike.
That was 48. Then there's
48 zinc oxide.
49 CSU strike.
Fine. Now, this was an attempt of the employers to smash up a union that was really led by lefties in the CP. And it was led in London, the solidarity actions by Harry Constable. And the Birkenhead port workers supported that demonstration, supported that strike. It got very little support in Liverpool. And therefore you had this Birkenhead port workers committee, which was much more homogeneous, much more closely knit than the Liverpool port workers committee. Because although in London the CP had suffered very badly by their failure to organise and lead the 1945 strike, in Liverpool the CP was a rather stronger force. Whereas in Birkenhead the CP had little or no support whatsoever. The CP in Birkenhead was absolutely irrelevant. Never had a real base, never had any leaders. And beginning with the early 50s, well, the late 40s and early 50s, the Birkenhead Port Workers Committee had always been in the orbit of Constable.
He'd made contact with them?
He was a very popular figure in the north, but he had a particular base inside Birkenhead. And by that time, Constable's politics were in the direction of Trotskyism. Was that all right? Constable's politics were Trotskyist in character. And he joined in the, I can't remember the exact date, but the early 50s, the Healey organisation.
This would be the Socialist Outlook Group.
Which was the Socialist Outlook Group, And I attended a meeting in Manchester in 1953. I was then a full-timer for the Socialist Outlook Group. And at this meeting, Constable was present and a number of dockers from Birkenhead. And the big discussion was, what way forward on the docks? Because Harry had been one of the seven dockers on trial in the 1951 Old Bailey trial, where they'd been prosecuted by a Labour government for taking strike action.
Hartley Shawcross,
Yeah, and the Minister of Labour was one and Iron Bevan.
That's right,
Regulation 1305, I think. And that had resulted, although the dockers got off, Constable had got expelled from the Transport and General Workers Union. And this is very important. It gives you an indication of the base that Constable enjoyed on the docks. But at that time, it was not possible to get a book. The book was what you presented when you went for work on the docks, unless you showed at the same time when you made your application for your book your trade union card. In other words, 100% trade unionism. And the TNG expelled Constable following the trial at the Old Bailey, and they also expelled Ted Dickens. Dickens joined the Blue Union after his expulsion from the TNG. Constable refused to join the Blue Union. And in consultation with the Healey Group, it was agreed he should fight for his reinstatement inside the Transport and General Workers Union. In other words, you don't give up your positions inside the trade union movement. And the big crunch came when Constable went to get his book, because he told him he couldn't have it. And the dock labour force in London walked out in solidarity with Constable. And that is a momentous thing, that you realise here's these dockers who have bitterly defended 100% trade unionism. And yet they were prepared to go on strike to permit a comrade, a worker, to work without a union card. But what they understood, and it showed a very high level of political awareness, what they understood, he was just fighting for reinstatement inside the union. But he could have copped out and joined the Blue Union. I think that illustrates two things, a very high level of consciousness amongst those dockers, and also this enormity of Constable's base.
He did eventually join the Blue Line, didn't he?
Now, in 1953, we had this discussion about what way forward. And until then, the position of the Trotskyists had always been that you have to fight for the unity on the docks. Their general position would be that you should fight for the fusion of the TNG and the Blue Union. And that we were opposed to any breakaway. But we'd reached the conclusion that it was not going to be possible in the given circumstances to change and reform the TNG, and that there was an actual movement growing up, irrespective of what we thought, which favoured going in the direction of Stevedores and Dockers Union. As I explained to you that on the tape that didn't work, that one of the things that people have to understand is that in the ETU, you might hate Chappell's guts, you might wish the fuck he was not in his union, but you haven't got an alternative, because Chappell's union organises electricians and plumbers. On the docks, you did have a different situation. There was an alternative union, named the National Amalgamated Stevedores and Dockers. It actually existed. Secondly, it was a union that formally and on paper had a very democratic structure. Its officials were elected, they were paid a wage very little more than the average dock worker, and the decisions to take strike action were taken not by the union bureaucracy, but in actual fact could only be taken at mass meetings, just as the decisions to return to work could only be taken at mass meetings. And for dockers, then this is something to bear in mind, that between 1945 and 1954, there was a fucking unofficial national strike on the British docks every year. Every year the dockers went into strike action. Now, I don't mean every single port in Britain joined, but every year there was a national unofficial strike, and every year, unfailingly, the TNG bureaucracy, headed by Deakin, completely opposed those strikes. And dockers were becoming very aware of something else, that the rest of the labour force in Britain had begun to take advantage of the post-war boom. Wages were improving for the best organised sections of the working class. And whilst wages had partly improved on the docks, and I'll give you an example of this, that it was never very easy to get support for a wages strike in London, because in London they had peace work. The London docks tended to come out on issues of solidarity and on issues of conditions. Like they had this big strike, I think it was 46, known as the Old Man's Strike.
Early 48.
Was it early 48?
Yes, that was the attempt to prune the registers.
That's right.
Yes, that's right. Defense. The Blue Union led that one.
Yes, defence of the older dockers. That's right. Whereas in Liverpool, they were always very quick to respond to wages questions because they were much less well paid.
That's right.
But one thing that did fuel this discontent on the docks was not just the fact that they were not getting the wages that they felt they were entitled to, but they didn't have the job security that the rest of the labour force in Britain tended to enjoy. That you could roll up on a Monday morning and get no work. You had to go back on a Monday dinner time and bump on again. So from day after day after day, you might not get... And you had a fallback guarantee by, in the 50s, even the 50s, only about £4.18 a week.
Yeah, that's right. It was 21 shillings in 1951. Well, it went up to 21 shillings a day. Mm. That was 1951.
Yeah. So this, of course, did mean that you got among stockers this real sense of exasperation, a real sense of discontent. And then, as I say, if you ally with that, there was a union that, in general, had adopted positions which were for better wages, more security of labour, and which they felt they could take over control of themselves, had led to a movement growing up which is independent of the desires of the Trotskyists. At this meeting, we discussed and agreed that what was going to be necessary, in our opinion, was a move of the dock labour force into the direction of the MS&D.
Who was at this meeting besides you and Harry Constable?
There was Constable, Johnson, yeah. McShane. Yeah. I can't remember though if Brandon was there. He probably was. Some of the local Trotskyists in Manchester, like Harry Ratner, people you wouldn't have heard of, and Debbie Healy.
Yeah, of course.
That's right, of course. And I had just become a full-timer then in the Healyite organisation. And my area included the North West. In other words, I had a particular responsibility for the Liverpool docks.
That's right. General Archison, used to go down to Birkenhead virtually every day.
That's right.
Spend a lot of time down there.
Exactly. Now, we therefore said that the first opportunity, the first time a new struggle breaks out, that rather than argue with dockers that, no, you've got to stay in TNG, our position would be for a move in the direction of the Stevedores Union. And in August 1954, this event occurred. And you've got all the details on
the grain dispute.
And on the Sunday morning, and it was in August, Jerry Healy drove myself, Bill Johnson, and Danny Brandon.
Yeah, he remembers this.
Over to Hull.
In an old beat up van.
I'll never forget, I decided the East Coast was the coolest fucking place in which humanity ever lived. Can you imagine an August Sunday morning? We were freezing to death. There was not a fucking single solitary cafe open. And I thought, Christ, have I got to do this to make a revolution? And there was a bloke whose name completely escapes me. It was a Catholic.
Wouldn't be Murphy, would it?
Yes, that's right.
Bill Murphy or John J. Murphy? J. Murphy? There's a Murphy who seems to be popping up all the time in Hull.
He was an ex-docker.
Left after the 45 strike.
Yes. Who, Hull had never been a port notorious then for its sort of advanced leadership, either at the trade union or political level. It had been considered a bit of a backwater. And when these workers had come into Sutherland strike, they, having no established leadership, they looked elsewhere for leadership. And they looked to Murphy.
This is the same, must be the same guy, must be.
And we went to see Murphy. And Murphy introduced us to, firstly, the strike leader, a young bloke called Elvis Hart.
Oh, yeah.
Another bloke called, I think, Eastwood. And we offered them our assistance, said they were prepared to help in the struggle, to do what we could with them. And I was quoted, I wasn't a docker, never been a docker, onto the strike committee in Hull. And the dockers voted unanimously, almost, to apply for membership at the Stevedores Union. Now, Barrett, who was the general secretary of the Stevedores Union, responded to this call. And one of the reasons he responded to this call was not simply that he had illusions of grandeur, although I think he probably did, but because the Stevedores Union had been engaged in a long dispute with the Dock Labour Board and the TNG in London.
It was over the overtime.
Over the overtime. Yeah. And was coming under enormous pressure and was beginning, and had lost, I think, his places on some of the Dock Labour Boards.
Well, they were certainly under a lot of pressure from the TNG. The TNG eventually forced them out of every single place.
I mean, you're dragging my memory back now, 30 odd years. And I'm not speaking from notes, I'm speaking from memory.
Yeah. Yes, that's more or less correct, isn't it? The way it seemed to happen was it seemed to be brewing in 53, and by 54, when the overtime dispute actually broke out.
I mean, if you quote this, I think it's important that you let me have a look so I can just verify and check the facts.
Absolutely.
And also that you yourself should check the facts.
I've got copious notes.
Fantastic. Because we are interested, I mean, you're obviously interested in producing something that is... It's factual and it's not just... So, it was this pressure that Barrett in his flight back announces that he's interested in these demands, and it goes to the executive of the Stevedores Union. Well, this dispute dragged on for quite a few days, and one thing that became very clear to me, that these strike leaders, and they were completely episodic figures, they were thrown up, as often workers will be in dispute, and afterwards they just disappeared back into the mass movement again and were not sort of ever seen as prominent leaders anymore.
Yeah.
That Hart, who was their sort of spokesman and their leader, and I remember sitting in Murphy's house one night and it was 12 o'clock at night. And I realised what was at stake here. What was at stake was a battle against Deakin and the Transport and General Workers bureaucracy. And there's big forces involved, not just the employers, but the union bureaucracy. And Albert Hart, I could see, was beginning to... There's a TV advert now, which is pretty obnoxious, called "Lot of Bottle, Lot of Bottle."
Yeah.
Well, Albert was losing his.
Yeah.
You could see it visibly wilting.
Yeah.
And these... blokes, who in no sense can you blame for this, were also beginning to sort of shake. And they said, look, I don't know what we're going to do next. And I remember arguing, I said, look, while you're sat here, the employers are also sat fucking wondering what they're going to do next. And they wanted to put a recommendation to go back to work. And I managed to persuade them that they should go, that Art and I should go and see Barrett the next day, and that only after a meeting with the executive of the Stevedores Union should they consider any proposals about going back to work or not. But not only that's a law that you don't break, is to take the strike leader out of town, but actually I was quite dying to get him out of town because I got a feeling he was going to get up at that mass meeting. And we went down to see Barrett, and I remember ringing up Healy, the SLO, and getting screamed at for doing this unpardonable thing. You take the strike leader away from his base. So I said, well, if you fucking hadn't, there wouldn't have been a base. You'd have had them all back. And he went off to see Barrett, and he met me at King's Cross, and we were getting our train back to Hull late in the afternoon that day. And suddenly, there was this paper we bought, and it announced that the employers had given in to the workers' demands about silo loving.
Yeah.
And of course that completely transformed the situation. Because when workers win, they go forward. When workers get defeated, and this is a sort of fallacy on the left, that the working class learns from its defeats. It's not true. The leadership of the working class learns from its defeats. The mass of fucking workers don't. The mass of workers get demoralised by defeats and retreat. When the working class had a big gain, it learns from its victories. And its confidence goes up. So it's people like you and I who are in political organisations that learn from defeats. The great mass of workers don't go off and read a pamphlet. They think, fucking hell, he can't win. It's dreadful, isn't it? And these workers having won, and therefore, within a very short time, there's an overwhelming vote by these whole workers to go into the Stevedores Union. Now, what this did do was ignite a movement in Liverpool, Birkenhead, and Manchester as a response.
because Barrett had actually accepted them, or his executive had. And at the same time, of course, Barrett recognised that he now had some forces, which enabled him to perhaps have some chance of turning the dispute around the overtime strike around back into the favour of the stevedores union. And in Birkenhead, we knew that the port of Birkenhead was very much anti-TNG. He's very pissed off with the TNG leadership. And also at the same time did follow the leadership of the Port Workers' Committee. I mean, this is quite bizarre, but the Port Workers' Committee was affiliated to the Healy Group.
The whole committee? Yeah. Does that mean, were they all members?
Well, it wasn't quite like that.
I mean,
Billy Johnson,
yeah.
Danny Brandon,
yeah.
Johnny McShane, Paddy McShane,
yeah.
And Billy Murphy were the central core of the Birkenhead Port Workers Committee.
And Harrison. Joe Harrison.
Yeah. Yes. Joe Harrison was a sort of very good speaker.
Yeah.
I'll give you a little anecdote about Joe Harrison. He did this meeting and he said, he's on Lord Street Blitzside. There must have been about 8,000 people there. You know Lord Street Blitzside, it was opposite the old central station.
Yeah.
He gets up and makes his speech. Brothers, as that great bard William Shakespeare says, the best laid plans of men and mice have gone astray. So somebody on the platform says, don't be fucking stupid, that was Robbie Burns. And Joe says through the mic, everybody can hear him, what does it matter as long as they think he's on his side? He's on their side. He didn't have the weight, the sort of political trade union leadership was these people.
Yeah.
And two of them were on the Healy Central Committee.
Who was that two?
Billy Johnson and Danny.
Yeah.
Brandon. Yeah.
That's interesting. That's more than he gave away anyway. Well,
it doesn't matter now, years have gone by. No, I wouldn't have told you this some years ago, we don't matter.
Well, Danny said he was involved in revolutionary politics, but he didn't go into details. That's interesting, actually.
I mean, a few years ago, I would probably not.
Yeah.
But now it's all water under the bridge.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's important for the historical record that the...
Well, yeah, Danny's not reticent about his involvement in socialist outlook. It's just that he didn't go into particular details.
I mean, there used to be then a sale at the Birkenhead docks of Socialist Outlook every week of between 50 to 60 copies a week. And if it carried information, like I said, the whole dock strike or big events of the union, it would sell 150, 180 copies. The Birkenhead labour force was probably somewhere in the region of about 2,400. And in those days, it was a very key port because it was mainly an export port.
I suppose another thing you may remember, but Danny said that often, he said most times between 45 and 56 would often be another 2,000 men from Liverpool.
That's right.
The That's so true. Often there was 4,000 men on the
That's
dock,
right.
Which is quite big for the site. For the
exactly.
Port.
Now, it was also a very tightly knit port. You know, when we were discussing earlier the thing that didn't recall, Birkenhead was very, very much a tightly knit port. It was second, third, fourth generation Irish, with a long tradition of hostility to employers, knit by the fact that they all lived in the same streets, drank in the same boozes, were members of the same clubs, and also were tied up with the same families. And this is pretty true in general over the docks, but in Birkenhead it was even the most sharpest. And this story I told you about Teddy Lawless, where he's speaking at number 8 dock and saying, well, I'll go and tell them why they're out. And I remember walking up the road and with a bloke called Georgie Cooper, and we passed this group of dockers, and he said, what are you doing? He said, we're out. So he said, oh, are you? And we just turned back. He never asked them why they were out, but if they're out, they're out, you don't fucking go to work.
Yeah.
And in other words, it's real solidarity.
Yeah.
And therefore, it was never going to be a problem. And namely, that the leadership in Birkenhead had come to the conclusion that they had to leave the TNG, that they were going into the Blue Union. And the SLL played quite a big, important role in this, decided that the next place to take was Birkenhead. From the point of view that if you could win Birkenhead, and they won it, I mean, there was only about three or four people who didn't join the Free Union of Birkenhead.
That's right, it seems, well, yes, at the time, though there was a drift, sure. There was a drift back later.
Oh, yes, know. That's a different question, but
yes,
it overwhelmingly solid, completely went over.
Yeah.
And the other important thing was that the sort of cadre, the leaders, the most best conscious, the most political, the most capable leaders, were there, which then gave them a base for an assault on Merseyside and an assault into Manchester.
Yeah.
And this, of course, impressed tremendously the people in the NASD headquarters in London. And in the late autumn, early winter of 1954, the NASD sent up a team of people to Merseyside to begin recruitment on the Liverpool docks.
That's right, there's quite a comprehensive report in the Echo of that.
That's right.
Which Newman was one.
They were led by Newman.
Dickens came down, didn't he, a couple of times?
Yes.
And let me think of else.
Dickens came down as a very reluctant.
Yes, he was, yes. Aylward, Bert Aylward came
Bert down. Aylward came down. Yeah. It was specially brought on to... He was a member of the executive.
Yeah.
But they especially put him on the payroll to organise this.
Yeah, that's right. And they set up a... He had an office, didn't he, in Birkenhead?
Yes, a bloke called Hurley.
That's right, that's another name.
Now, I was not... I was then a full-timer for the SLL.
Yeah.
But because of the connections to the Birkenhead Port Workers Committee, and I began to... I met these people... And they asked me, would I go and work full-time for the union as part of the recruitment drive.
So he was basically doing organising work for them.
And I was sent to... we had an office in every control shop. Mm. And I went to work in number 5 control, where I met Peter Kerrigan, who I then was able to recruit to the...
So he actually came join the SLL through the dispute?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
I recruited him. I remember sitting with Peter Kerrigan discussing both the dispute and lending him my copy of Revolution Betrayed.
That's interesting, because John Archer said that he thought Peter Kerrigan was one of the most politically conscious of the dockers.
He was.
He thought he was, you know, which... Well, see, John Archer... It's interesting what you say, because John Archer thought that Harry Constable was never a member of the SLL.
He's a member of its central committee.
Yeah, didn't John,
people's memories, yeah. I mean.
He thought that John, Harry Constable was one of those industrial workers that you meet who becomes a sympathiser, is always involved with you, but never quite makes the commitment.
He was an actual member.
That makes a lot of interest, because that means that you actually had quite a solid core.
So was Bert Aylward.
Bert Aylward was a member.
Oh, yes. Aylward was a member of the SLR.
That shows you what a solid industrial core they actually had. I mean, it makes it much clearer that they actually had that hardcore of
the members of the SLL, I'll just briefly go through them and give you an idea of them.
Yeah.
Was Billy Johnson, who was a full-time official in Birkenhead.
Yeah.
John McShane, who later was sent by the Blue Union to organise Manchester Port.
Yeah.
Peter Kerrigan, who lost his book on the docks and eventually became a full-time official of the Blue Union.
Yeah.
Myself, who was the editor of News of the Blues and a full-time organiser. I mean, I produced and edited News of the Blues. Bert Aylward, who eventually became National Docks Secretary of the Union.
Yeah.
Harry Constable.
Of course, yeah.
Joe Bramall for a very short time. He was a former crane driver who worked full-time for the Blue Union. Paddy Murphy.
This is the Birkenhead.
Billy Murphy, sorry, from Birkenhead.
Yeah.
Paddy McShane.
Yeah.
Billy Connors, another Birkenhead port worker.
So most of them were from Liverpool, or from Birkenhead, Liverpool?
Another worker from Liverpool called Ely.
Yeah.
And the guy who was the leader for a time of the number 10 control in Liverpool, who joined.
Who's that?
think his name was Donovan, or his name escapes me now.
What about this bloke Joe Hooley from Garston? Does he ever remember? Because one of the
no, he was a sympathiser.
Because one of the blokes who I interviewed said, well, this Joe Hooley was a good bloke, like, but it was a bit of a commo, he said. That was his words, you know, and I thought, hello, this sounds like a good bloke to find, you know, he's obviously...
He was sympathetic.
Yeah.
Then there were people like Frank O'Brien, who was the leader of Number 8 Control.
Yeah.
People like Cassidy, who was the leader of Number 7 Control. Yeah. We were never members of the SLL, but were in that wing of the SLL of sympathy.
Yeah.
And were sort of sympathetic to Constable, Matt Shane.
Your periphery,
to me. And they were the periphery, and they were leaders. And then the guy in Number 3 Control, whose name I'm fucking fucking remember. Not Bembo.
Well, but was Jim Bembo a sympathiser?
Jim Bembo knew people like myself, knew people like Healy, knew what our politics were. But always slightly distanced himself. And was just sort of a bit of your upright militant.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time was prepared to collaborate and work with.
Oh, yeah.
Now... From there, they went to Liverpool. My estimation is that at the peak, they recruited something like 12 out of 18,000 dockers in Liverpool, at their peak.
Yeah.
The big crunch in Liverpool came around the question of the books.
Yeah.
And they all went to get the books. And again, Nudger Harrison, who was a full-time official, was sympathetic and prepared to work with the SLL. I mean, Nudge was an idiosyncratic individual, but he was prepared to work with the SLL, collaborate with it. In other words, Trotskyism had there quite a mass base. And there is no doubt that without the organisation of the Trotskyists, without the drive of the Trotskyists, there wouldn't have been a blue union.
I mean, that it was really those activists who were pushed behind.
That's right. There was at the base a desire to get out of the TNG and find a union in which the membership could control and influence and in which there could be much more democracy. The TNG has gone through some very profound changes since then.
Absolutely.
And I personally think that part of the balance sheet which we'll have to make is that it is a result of that big crisis inside the union that made people like Frank Cousins, who came along later as General Secretary,
that long later, really.
Introduced an old number of reforms in the union.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that what the TNG was scared of is that this contagious disease, i.e. a breakaway, could start spreading to other sections inside
of
the union.
They already had trouble with the busmen being Well, it's funny, it's interesting you say that, but I said to Danny Brandon, I said, well, hey, look, Danny, you know, after what happened, do you think he was right in splitting? And he said, yes, I think we were right in the sense that it would have happened anyway at some point in time, the men would have gone. But he said, on reflection, he said, after it all died down and the blue had all, and the thing had failed, he said he thought probably the best thing he would have done was to have gone back into the TNG. I mean, that was his opinion. He said that having tried and failed, then the best thing would have been to abandon and go back. But he said that wasn't to be, but he said at the time it looked like it was going to succeed. And he said he thought there was a fair chance of taking the whole of Port of Liverpool and London.
Well, yes, if they'd have won the recognition strike of May 55, and I'm getting a bit... If you want another interview, I'm prepared to give you one later on the recognition strike, not tonight. There is no doubt that they would have won the ports throughout Britain.
Yeah.
Now, the big mistake that, in my opinion, the Trotskyists made, or myself as a Trotskyist and others, was that we should have then said, we haven't won. We have now got to go back as an organised force inside the Transport and General Workers Union. And we failed to do that. And we failed to understand this really basic lesson about working class politics. You can't build on defeats. And it was not possible to create... I mean, the reason for the strike, and as I said, I'd rather if you came across another night, I wouldn't mind thinking about it and going through it all again.
Good idea.
I mean, I was the person from the FM moved at the SLL meeting the day to the strike.
Yeah.
Bit of sort of Docker's caucus. But once that had been gone, we should have gone back. Yeah. Anyway, so we're
I was one of the people that was very, very directly involved in determining the date of the strike.
Yeah.
And at a caucus meeting of Dockers who were in the SLL and its closest supporters, I actually moved the strike date.
Yeah.
So it's very easy for me to rationalise and say it was the best time. Because, I mean, I'm defending my own history.
Mm.
Just as it's easy for Danny to be wise in hindsight.
Yeah, well, which I think...
But, I mean, see, he is right. We were being provoked. The employers were conscious that the Blue Union was gaining ground. The TNG were conscious of this. And there was an alliance between the Transport and General Workers Union and the employers, because between them they'd been responsible, through the way the Dock Labour Board is set up, for ensuring that they could discipline militants and drive them off the docks. Danny Bandon is a perfect example.
Yeah, yeah.
Johnny McShane, Peter Gerrigan, I could rattle them off one by one. And the Blue Union therefore constituted to them a very, very big threat. Because it threatened to take out of the hands of a fairly tame, acquiescent union, which had complied and collaborated with the employers. Who wants a Bert Aylward when you can have a PJ O'Hare? Because Aylward was in favour of mass democracy, members deciding things. O'Hare was in favour of fuck the members, sack them if they're a nuisance, and I'll collaborate with you. And employers like that one and don't like the other one. Now, I think it's James B. Cannon, the old American Trotskyist, says in politics, the essence of it is timing. It's probably true. So after we'd won the books dispute, we went really on the upsurge. Did this affect our judgment? Possibly. However, these workers wanted results. And when they saw in this train drivers thing that you're talking about, I mean, I don't remember all the details, but if you couldn't fight back, I used to get the phone ringing in the office. We've got a dispute here about carbon black. We've got a dispute about these fucking tomatoes here. We've got this. And you went down and the employers refused to talk to you. And then these workers were feeling like, fucking hell, there's no point being in a union if we can't get these things. I think we'd reached a sort of peak. And I don't see how we could have consolidated anymore. There was nothing to consolidate with after that. We'd gone as far as we could. We'd got 2/3 of the labour force in the union in Liverpool. So there we'd completely tied up broken head. We've got a big majority in Manchester. We've got a majority in Hull. And we were getting feelers and interest in other ports, but they'd not yet taken any steps. How we were going to consolidate it to produce some results. And therefore, I think the date was set by powerful objective circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we had to respond to. I don't know if you've read your Plekhanov, but where he is, did great men make history? And he points out that they do and they don't. That you can be a very great person, but if there's no fucking opportunities come your way, if the objective circumstances don't give you any chances, you'll die unknown. But the thing about the Napoleons and the Trotskys and the Lenins is the objective circumstances were there, and they knew how to subjectively intervene. Now, the objective circumstances were there. They demanded it. If we hadn't, it would have started rolling back again.
So you felt you had to go with me?
We didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
Now, I think... I don't know. I mean, I think you could argue that maybe another month, few weeks, but I honestly feel, and I do, I don't just want to sort of rationalise my own historical role. I don't want to do that a long time ago. Yeah. You're trying to produce a thesis, not a justification of individuals' roles, because that doesn't educate the people who read this stuff. You could have argued that we might have held off for a month. I mean, I think a mistake that we did make, and this is a time factor, was the Naslef strike.
Yeah.
That was a real fucking hindrance, because it meant that the impact of the dock strike was less. Yeah. But you're not talking about 6 months. Yeah. You'd have gone backwards anyway.
Yeah. So, when the actual... when
I caught your speech at Johnny McShane's. Yeah. It was in The Guardian. McShane says, quote from Shakespeare, there's a time and a tide in the life of all men.
Yeah.
And I forget the rest of the quotes, and you have to grab it. The Guardian was quite intrigued by this. Birkin had done that for the desk mass meetings and quote Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And the time and tide was there. If you hadn't have grabbed then, you had only got another few weeks left. It possibly was. We might have been better to wait another week or two, but it's not.
Not crucial, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, yeah, I can understand that because, I mean, I think Danny possibly would have wished for thinking on Danny's part, I mean, but maybe.
Well, I don't want to criticise him.
Well, no, but I mean, then again, Danny, as you know, because he's a sharp bloke, he thought it out.
Mm.
And thought maybe that wasn't, you know, if Cosby fell, maybe it would have been better to go. Time.
You must remember now that by this, Danny was very much on the sidelines then.
Yeah. Well, yes, as he himself said, yeah.
Of course he did. Yeah. First birth, so.
Yeah. So, once you decided to go, I mean, obviously the strike was very successful in Birkenhead, that goes without saying. But in Liverpool, he didn't quite have the same success in the sense that, well, the usual figures are quoted, 10,000 to 12,000 men out. I mean, I don't know, is that a fair estimate of the men who came out?
It was more than that.
Was it?
Mm. But we were satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
In Liverpool, we were dismayed about London.
Yeah, it was very little. Was it most just the Blueberry that came out?
Well, no, there was pockets of white came out. But what fucked us in London? Like, in Liverpool, the CP... were not strong enough and were unsure. They couldn't wait a systematic campaign against the strike.
Mm.
In London, you had the CP and the Lightermen on the committee moving fucking resolutions to go back to work. That's all right. The time and systematically arguing against the strike. Ben Barrett fucked off and went hopping. Now, can you believe it? Can you imagine the psychological effect?
Yeah.
On these ordinary dock workers and the leader of the strike. Like, say the miners were on strike and Arthur Scarborough went off fucking winkling. I mean, can you see the enormity of it? And nobody could find him.
Yeah.
It's absolutely unobtainable.
Yeah. I couldn't believe when I read in the papers actually.
He just went.
Yeah.
In other words, he what is commonly known as lost his bottle.
Yeah, yeah.
Then?
I was going to say that could be said of certainly half of the executive.
The executive, yeah. I mean, you must realise that these were very small people who had never been confronted, where every fucking wing was against them. The media, the Labour Party, the trade unions, the TUC.
Mm.
Everything. Oh, the employers. And here are these little people who are not in political organisations, who have no perspective, who are not even the sort of equivalent often of Labour councillors.
Yeah.
I think Jerry Healy once put it to me very well when we sat in a cafe in Liverpool. He said, the men with the gaiters. You know, gaiters, G-A-I-T-R.
Yeah.
Stevedores. And in many ways they were.
Yeah.
Primeval almost.
Yeah.
Now, it's difficult for revolutionists to face up to such mass hostility. It's not easy. But these people are funny. And they carried a vote to return to work.
That's right.
Whereupon we organised a mass meeting in Liverpool for them to put the return to work motion. It was held on Lord Street Blitz site. But what we did do is we organised that the platform would be seized. And there was this orator, a bloke called George Nugent. And as the return to work motion was being put, the platform was seized and Nugent grabbed the mic and made this big speech about how we were not prepared to give in, said we'd have to continue, and the executive decision got overturned.
Yeah. But the feeling was obviously there in Liverpool to stay out.
Yes. Now, of course, yes, but what you have to understand is that was the beginning of the end. If, as I say, your national secretary is fucked off, if your national executive is shitting in his trousers and does, and has shown it's not prepared to fight, if the lightermen, led by the Stalinists, are anti-strike, but yet in the strike committee...
Yeah. Yeah.
See, they're on the sort of liaison-type committee that's been set up. But the workers in the north have this feeling of completely being embattled and isolated.
Yeah.
Now, there, in many ways, it was a model strike. We produced, most of the time, a duplicated daily strike bulletin.
Yeah.